Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I am back home. I literally just flew in from Seattle yesterday, back home to the Rock here in North Wales. I'm definitely glad to be home after 6 weeks of being in Seattle. But you know what? While I was over there in the States, I met up with a ton of ex-evangelical or ex-evangelical folks. I will give you a super fast rundown of some of the really cool stuff that I was able to get done while I was over there. For one thing, me and Canadian Stacey Ray, her and some friends drove all the way down from Canada on the 15th and 16th of September. Stacy and I did a live podcast on the 16th of September. We talked about reconstruction after deconstruction, and it was about a little over an hour, hour and a half, something like that. And I'm going to be bringing you that as a podcast probably in two episodes, I think, coming up here in a little bit. But I also did some other podcast recordings, man. I met with so many people. I went down to Portland. I did a great recording with Andrew Gurevich, who was on the show before. I think last year we did a couple of episodes and we did a great recording down in Portland. I also met with a guy named Jimmy Brower who came to our live podcast. And so talking to Jimmy at the live podcast and the lunch we had afterwards, I realized this guy's got an amazing story. So we set up a meeting. So he came back on his way through home to Eugene, Oregon, and we did a podcast there in Seattle. And talk about hardcore commitment. I think he got home at like 4 a.m. It was great of Jimmy to stop by, and we had a really good conversation about his own deconstruction. I also met with Steve Slocum, who has written a book about Muslim-Christian-American relations called Why Do They Hate Us? So we recorded that podcast too. I also brought you last week a special one-off edition with Andy Herndon, talking about his new documentary that he's working on, hopefully filming sometime in January of next year, called The Ex-Evangelicals, a documentary. I mean, there's so much stuff that I was able to get done while I was over in the States. We also had a great ex-evangelical meetup, a dinner, one of the nights in October, not long before I left. So, you know what? It was really good. In fact, what I'm hoping to do when I go back over to the States is meet up with a bunch of people from the ex-evangelical Northwest area. We want to do another podcast with a group of us. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm not sure when I'm going to be back over, if it's going to be before the end of this year or sometime in the spring, but I'm looking forward to meeting up with more and more people. So you know what? It was a great trip overall. I'm definitely glad to be back. I'm a little bit jet lagged, but hey, I'm home. And what's cool about the whole thing is I finally kind of caught back up. I had done so many podcast episodes before I left. They were all queued up. And so I wasn't able to do any sort of edits or changes or bring you any sort of fresh information. But I wanted to mention real quickly that we've had some people become Patreon supporters of Mindshift Podcast. And I wanted to give a shout out to Mandy Lorham. We've also had Alistair McCallum from Scotland, as well as T. Sebastian. So it's really encouraging to see people supporting the work that I'm doing and to make that decision to go ahead and become Patreon supporters of Mindshift Podcast. And you can too, for as little as a dollar a month. And what does that buck a month get you? Well, there's some great rewards, actually, if you become a supporter. For one thing, you get early releases of the episodes on Wednesdays instead of having to wait till Fridays. Another thing I've been releasing only on Patreon are my pre-recording conversations that I have with my guests before we hit the record button. I'll give you kind of a behind the scenes of what we talk about and what we're going to be talking about. Also, I've been doing some stuff where I've interacted with some of the guests that I've had and kind of gone through and sort of done a reflection piece. And it's kind of a resource for people who are deconstructing. And so I'll put those up on Patreon as well. So there's a lot of really good stuff. The other thing is, it's really cool. The last several months, what I've been doing is I've been adding some of the guests that I've had in the past into our closed Facebook group. And that is really a cool thing. The more I think about that, because if you become a member, you get added into our closed group, but it's a great way to meet up and talk to people that were on the show. You can ask them questions. You can get their feedback. You can contact them directly. if you don't have any other way of getting a hold of them, they're all in that group. So these are some of the things I've been working on to give the supporters of this show some extra rewards, some great content for those who believe in what I'm doing. And really, that makes a great segue to talk about today's guest. I'm bringing you part two with Dr. Josie McSkimming. If you listen to last week's episode, I talked to her. She lives in Sydney, Australia. She is a clinical social worker, and a lot of her work is counseling people who come out of fundamentalist religion. And in fact, she is the author of a book. It's called Leaving Christian Fundamentalism and the Reconstruction of Identity. And I think that pretty much encapsulates exactly what we talked about last week and what kind of this kick that I've been on lately. Again, going back to the live podcast that I did with Stacey Ray, something I've really been focusing on in the last few months is this issue of reconstruction after deconstruction. What are the dynamics? What are the elements involved in when a person starts to deconstruct or question certain elements of their faith? And we've heard some of the women, particularly, we heard Cindy Wong Brandt and Josie as well, said last week that as a woman living with this cognitive dissonance, you know, some things just didn't fit in her own experience of the church. This is something both Cindy and Josie said, that when they were in evangelicalism, they were questioning things like the role of women, and it just didn't fit. The idea that you had the women couldn't be in leadership, and the women couldn't question things, and they had to be silent, and they weren't allowed to do a lot of things, and that didn't fit their own lived experiences in the world. And these were some of the seeds, the early questions that came up that fed into their deconstruction. And all of this cognitive dissonance, it finally just proved the weight was too much. It proved to be too much. They both decided, I've got to walk away from this system. And basically what they said to themselves was, I can no longer continue to prop up this system. I can't do it anymore. And this is where Josie and I ended last week's conversation. This issue of when a person within Christianity, or really any religion, any kind of fundamentalist controlling religion, starts to question his or her belief system or relationship with that religion, what do? A lot of times we see them either doubling down, digging in even further, or they start to deconstruct. And then a lot of times what happens is they're no longer able to stay in that system. And this is where the conversation ended with Josie last week. She was talking about her own experience. And I like the way she ended her quote, and I've replayed it again this week, that the problem with this living with cognitive dissonance, as she said, earning a black belt. Most Christians must be earning a black belt in cognitive dissonance to stay within the system, to suppress the doubts, to suppress the questions. She said, the problem with the whole thing is it lacks integrity. I would rather be a person of integrity than support or prop up a system that is fundamentally cruel and oppressive. And that's where we ended it last week. And we're going to pick that up this week in part two. So here we go with Dr. Josie McSkimming, earning a black belt in cognitive dissonance.
But when these moments would happen, I would go searching for reassurances that, you know, what I believed was okay and what my community was doing was okay. And you would think, well, I don't understand it, but these pastors, these leaders, they seem to accept it, so I guess I should. I mean, there were all kinds of ways of shoring up a faith or a set of beliefs or even a sense of self that was kind of falling apart at the seams. And I remember doing that myself.
Oh, I did too.
And it's only when you kind of think this lacks integrity, really, that the change starts to occur. Maybe that's with youth and with aging and with the wisdom of recognizing that integrity is more important than shoring up something that is ultimately unethical and cruel.
And I think, too, for a lot of people who have walked away from that whole thing and put that whole cognitive dissonance piece behind them, they say that they, just in terms of their own peace of mind, their own mental health, it's like night and day. Because I feel like I'm a totally different person than I was when I was in the church. I was always full of anxiety for a lot of reasons. Partly because I was always felt like I never measured up to God's standards, and I never measured up to the standards that I, as a leader and a teacher and a pastor, was telling my congregation or students that they needed to be this ideal Christian. But I knew I wasn't doing it myself. So I was always full of anxiety. My stomach was always in knots because I knew really I was kind of a fraud, kind of a phony. The imposter syndrome comes into play.
Yes.
So you're living with all this tension all the time. And it's a terrible thing to live in for your own mental health, if nothing else.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, really? And certainly people in my book spoke of needing mental health support while they were in the church, but once they left, they actually needed it less.
So yeah, how
contrary
ironic.
To those ideas that, oh gosh, once you leave the church, you're just going to fall apart.
Your life's going to be ruined.
People found a sense of stability. They started to change. You know, remember too that fear of apostasy that a lot of us were kind of schooled in, that if you leave, you won't have any kind of moral compass anymore.
Yeah, you're
that
truly
there'll
lost.
Be this terrible slide into moral anarchy, that somehow Western civilization has this moral capital in our Western society, and slowly we're expending and, you know, all this moral capital. So in the end, as we progress towards secularization, there'll just be nothing but moral relativism. Now, I was raised on that, and I bet you were too.
Oh, yes, I
can
remember.
But in fact, once I left, I kind of felt so much more connected to my moral decision-making, the real effects of my decision on other people, the kind of the real taking responsibility for ethical decision-making, being able to consider everything afresh rather than, as you said, with that constant anxiety of not measuring up, being a bad Christian, being a bad woman, particularly. I was always such a kind of a disappointing female Christian because, you know, I spoke up and spoke back to my husband or whatever else I was doing that was considered to be unhelpful.
It wasn't, and certainly wasn't in the godly biblical pattern of that Proverbs 31 wife, was it? You couldn't live up to that standard. I don't know anyone who could.
Learning quietly at home in quiet submission. That was the one that always killed me because I was just never the quiet submission kind. I mean, I consider myself very fortunate, or maybe it was just good management on our part, but my husband and I have stayed together through all of this and progressed on slightly different paths, but have come to a real meeting around, you know, this kind of this whole spiritual journey. Some of the people that I know from the church who were kind of told to marry various people because there was so much control, marry this person because they're a Christian, even though you might not like them much. Well, we did as we were told. A lot of their marriages have broken up. A lot of those old friends I had who moved into the ministry or moved into theological teaching and training are miserable. Marriages broken up, really struggling with that. You know, I was told not to marry my husband by a various authority figure. I'm kind of thinking how prescient, how wise I was to marry him against that advice.
You're so fortunate. You married the right person against all godly wisdom and advice, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
how they
Which
saw
is
it.
Kind of funny.
Very ironic, again. Well, can we get into your book? Because you've mentioned the word fundamentalism and control. What is it about fundamentalism? What are some of the hallmarks of it as a movement? Because obviously it's not confined to Christianity. It's a religious thing, but you can see it in politics and elsewhere. What is it about fundamentalism that is so damaging to someone's psychological, emotional, sexual health?
Well, it's interesting you say that, of course, because we have, in my view, problems in fundamentalist Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Again, the Abrahamic faiths. And
yes.
There is quite a lot of debate in the literature about the differences within Christianity between fundamentalism and evangelicalism. And I won't go into all of that because that's probably a little bit of an academic thing. But I find it helpful to kind of think of fundamentalism, particularly in a new, more newer definitions that we use. It's about an ideology which kind of has an absolutist kind of hermeneutic. That is that what I say or what I teach or what we say or what we teach is the truth. And so even if it's not a literal interpretation of biblical text, it's got this idea of an inerrancy, but you don't really have the freedom to question it and digest it and think about it for yourself. There really isn't any gap between the holy text, as it were, and what I say it means. And that was my experience, that our teaching was, this is what it means. And if you said, oh, well, could it mean this and this? No, it actually means this. And I know for some fundamentalists it means literal interpretations by the world created in 7 actual days, but I don't think that's necessarily a requirement of fundamentalism, because I think that once you've got that absolutist quality to it, you know, it's a kind of a much broader kind of definition. We had a lot of invitations to, you know, theological correctness when I was growing up, that there were people in your group and others appointed to just keep an eye on the purity, the accuracy of your theological interpretation. And, you know, I think that for other fundamentalisms, and I'll just quote the historian I mentioned before, Karen Armstrong, she says that what all these fundamentalisms have in common is something called militant piety, which is a kind of a rather nice phrase. I certainly know militant piety, and oh, yes. I think a lot of other people do.
I was raised in it too.
Obviously, not all fundamentalist movements are the same, but they have family resemblances, let's say.
Definitely. I've studied a lot of the Christian fundamentalist movement in the late 19th century into the early 20th century, and that's one of the phrases or words that comes up quite a bit, is how militant they were against the liberals.
Yes.
Again, and it was obviously a very reactionary movement, at least in Christian fundamentalism in the West, against the perceived destruction of Orthodox Christianity by liberal theology coming out of Germany and other places, and they were very concerned about it.
And secularism and modernism.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, all of these things. And so there was this kind of, you know, remember the phrase comes out of that movement that was protecting the so-called fundamentals.
Exactly. You had to believe them and be a Christian.
Yeah, you'd be familiar with that.
Well, and the one that always strikes me that's so bizarre is one of the fundamentals was you had to believe that Moses was the author of the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of the Bible.
If you denied that,
you weren't even a Christian. So that shows you how far they were willing to go with what they believed in terms of the attacks against the Bible and everything else, that if you believe that it was not all written by Moses, you're not even a Christian. So you're in or you're out. Very binary thinking, very black and white thinking. But then you combine that with the God that this view promotes. The view of God that I was taught and that I came to believe in was as a result of this sort of fundamentalist belief. And it's a surveilling sort of God. I think you mentioned that before. This God's always watching you, and so are the other people around you. You're in a culture that you're being watched all the time by both God and your fellow Christians, that you don't slip up for one second.
Well, you see, this is one of the arguments of my book that I speak about the French philosopher Michel Foucault, who borrowed the term panopticon to describe modern power, and the panopticon being an actual architectural device where those who are kind of in a prison situation are always under surveillance from a central observation tower. And he argues then that this kind of internalized surveillance becomes a form of control, because people always don't know if they're being watched or not, so they regulate their behavior accordingly. And so I think that that self-surveillance is a huge thing, and that happens, and people, you know, enforce it in these communities such that, and again, you know, I guess I'm talking about my experience, that certain kind of strange contradictions emerge while you are watching yourself, checking yourself, your rightness as a Christian, the rightness of your theology, the rightness of your Christian practice. But we were kind of told in this Protestant tradition that we could think, we could work things out for ourselves, that there were, you know, kind of lots of freedom within Christianity to take different views on things. That there were some things like Jesus is God is kind of about the only certain thing. Yeah, well, that was said on one hand, and on the other hand, as you say, if you don't kind of have a belief about Moses writing the Pentateuch, or if you don't say women need to be quiet in church and not have any leadership position, then these were so-called gospel issues. These affected your eternal salvation. These were the shibboleths or the tests to work out if you were in or you were out.
Or you're out.
And so the minute you'd start saying things like, well, you know, can't women be you under certain circumstances, whoa, that was a test you failed.
You just failed.
Well, you just failed it.
You just failed it.
You know, even though you'd been told on one hand, look, you know, there are kind of gospel essentials and then there's, you know, kind of freedom to think for yourself. No, in reality, that isn't the truth at all. You fail tests all the time, and that contributes to that chronic anxiety, I think.
Well, and just plug in one other piece to this whole discussion, and that is the question of whether or not a person can lose his or her salvation. I can remember as a young Christian obsessing over this, and of course, there's different schools of thought. You've got the Calvinist, the Arminian, blah, blah, blah. But it's a huge obsession because I was super worried about it because, as you say, if you're already doubting whether or not you're really a true Christian, whether you're going to go to heaven when you die, or you might miss the rapture or something like that, then you start worrying about, well, if I'm not careful enough, I might do something to lose my salvation. So I really need that certainty to know that I can't lose my salvation. It's all important. I mean, there's no other greater threat than an eternal punishment in hell. You can't raise the stakes any higher than that. That's the ultimate ace card. And so I didn't want to go to hell.
There was never any reasonable or plausible answer to that question about losing salvation and the unforgivable sin. And had you committed the unforgivable sin? You know, I guess I've just come to understand that whoever God is, the idea that he or she would be so binary, so capricious, so cruel to kind of make decisions about people's eternal destination based on such strange, you know, trivial, puerile kind of matters.
Very petty.
You know, very petty. And whoever God is, and I'm working on that, I think that God is a lot bigger than that, you know. Even Jesus said, many will come to me and say, and, you know, Lord, Lord, and he'll say, I never knew you. Now, that was always put to us as, you know, those non-Christians and those heathen, but, you know, maybe things are a little more complicated than we were taught.
Could be. I always play with a scenario whereby I imagine a person dies and goes and stands before St. Peter at the pearly gates and he says, why should I let you into heaven? And he'll say, did you believe that Moses wrote the Pentateuch? And they'll say, no. Oh, you're going to hell then. You can plug in any answer. Oh, you didn't speak in tongues, so you're not a Christian. Oh, you didn't believe that you believe that women should be allowed to preach, so you're going to hell. You can put anything in there to be that determining factor, and you have to step back and go, really? Is this all about correct beliefs, exactly right? And if you have them wrong, you're not going to get into heaven. That's pretty stringent for the requirements. Sure.
I think it was said to me too that if you had some of these, you know, wrong thinking, as you're describing it, you know, you think women might be able to preach or whatever, that you might be saved, but through the fire, as that verse says.
Yeah, you won't have any rewards.
The fire. So you might just scrape.
Just scrape in.
It's all a bit risky.
It's very
and
risky.
And it's all a bit uncertain, which will increase your anxiety, but you might just scrape through. But when you talk about this as a system for living and a way of kind of constructing a meaningful sense of self, you can see how this just plays havoc with people's choices, you know, in apparent liberal democracy.
It's ironic. It's the ultimate irony. Well, what are the people that you counsel or the people that you've interviewed for your book? Is there kind of a shared narrative that you see? Obviously, every person's different. For them, deconstruction's different. Do you find sort of common threads that come out of your research?
Look, I did. And my research was very detailed and qualitative in nature. And I tried to look at the interviews in many different ways so I could really kind of get to the richness of the data. But there are various journeys out beyond fundamentalism. And I have to say that certainly the people I interviewed and the people that I speak to who have undergone great changes, you know, as I've come to know them through counselling, there is great relief. There is a sense of renewal, a sense of possibility. There isn't a descent into kind of shocking immoral behaviour.
Right,
there isn't
slide.
A descent into depression. The vast majority of people describe relief, renewal, freedom, and a reconstruction of themselves. And I think this was the interesting thing. I was very interested in that idea of a new ethical self once you'd actually moved away from the absolutism or fundamentalism. And a lot of my interviews are about how people found a new ethical substance, how they found a new spirituality, how they started to tolerate less certainty in their life, that they were quite happy to be in places of movement and flow and a grayness rather than the black and whiteness that they had been in before. That they, some people even spoke of new creativity, whereas the creativity had been focused on the church, playing music in the church, writing Christian songs, only allowing your creativity within those kinds of parameters, that there could be great bursts of freedom, a great burst of creative freedom beyond those kinds of parameters. People were kind of quite thrilled to discover that there are diverse modes of living your life, many stories that you can live your life by, that not that I'm saying that, you know, life is a banquet where everybody can freely choose. Lots of people are constrained by sexuality, by poverty, by social class. I mean, I'm not kind of saying that a humorist in this sense that people can just choose. But I think that people, once they're aware that there are various structures and ways of relating to themselves and the world that have constrained them, those structures, those beliefs, those discourses, those teachings, those groups of people, once they can uncouple themselves from that, literally uncouple themselves like a train, like in train carriages.
Yeah, you have to disentangle, really.
You do. And it is often quite deliberate. But moral agency emerges. And I found this very interesting in the interviews. And I think a lot of people who have enormous fears about so-called apostasy and enormous fears about moral decline, whatever, may find some kind of hope and strength in these stories. That these are very different people, men, women, gay, straight, two had theological training and were involved in theological teaching. One was transgender. They just kind of found what they would describe as a more healthy way of being. And this was something that was unknown to me as a young Christian and to be regarded with enormous suspicion.
Exactly. And it's the ironic thing. We've said many times as we've been talking, there's so many ironies in all of this. One of the things I learned too from David Hayward, who was on this podcast as well, he said that it takes a lifetime to disentangle yourself because religion is, it's all pervasive. Every decision that we made, every aspect of our lives was filtered through this lens of, okay, what's God's will for me? What does the Bible say about this? Should I do this? I'm building relationships with a person for the purpose of preaching the gospel to them. And so everything we had, everything we did was filtered through the lens and through the prism of religion and this surveilling God and watching ourselves. So to disentangle yourself from that, this is your very identity. You can't just say, I'm going to deconstruct and I'll be fine in 5 minutes. No, no, no. This is a lifelong process and we can often get triggered by things that are completely unexpected. And then we have to go back and deal with all this stuff that suddenly bubbles up. And we thought, oh, I thought I was all over that. No, it's all part of this lifelong process of, like you say, disentangling, detaching from the person we were for most of our lives in many cases.
Sort of reworking it. I mean, here we have you and I having this conversation, and it's been many years since I've actually been a part of a church community, and yet we are still engaged and, you know, really interested in having this conversation. I think it's like this kind of mental furniture in your head. It's there. You've got to keep rearranging it, and hopefully you get to a point where you're kind of reasonably happy with the decor. Yeah. But, you know, I don't believe that anybody is fixed. I don't believe that human nature is fixed. I don't believe there's a kind of an essential real me or an essential real you. I think that we are in a state of flux and changing identity all the time, which I think is a great release. And there's great freedom that we don't have to drill down to find our real self. I don't think there is a real self. I think there's lots of stories of the self, and some can be brought forward and some can be archived. My old Christian stories are archived.
Well, and I think I really like what you said, because it was such a part of our lives. I think that's why I still care. And I can see over the last few years, my position has shifted, where when I first started this podcast and I did a lot of writing on my website about trying to fix the church from without, to be that lone voice of the prophetic voice, sort of saying, hey guys, there's a lot of problems in here, but we can fix it. We can go back to some sort of biblical values and blah, blah, blah. And I've changed now. I'm realizing, no, I'm not trying to fix the church anymore. I'm actually now helping people like you who have come out of it, and we have this lived, this shared experience. That's what I'm more passionate about, is talking to people like you. And I mean, look at the fact that I'm a transplanted American living in the United Kingdom. You're coming from Australia, but we have a lot of shared stories and narratives that all somehow come together. So I think it's fantastic that we've met up. I'm super happy to have, you know, had this conversation with you. This has been great.
Well, I think it's interesting also what you just said about trying to kind of do this change from without. I was in a very similar situation, having spent many years trying to do the change from within.
Exactly.
I used to run Bible studies that were a little bit different. I used to try and allow and encourage different ways of thinking. I used to kind of challenge the preachers.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
In the end, the cost to me was just too high, and to my family, and my ability to influence the situation and to do this change from within, I mean, it was so limited. And so then you try and do the change from without, and then you think, no, the church themselves, you know, they need to take some responsibility. And if they really were interested in issues of abuse, domestic violence, of why do people leave, come and ask us. Be interested. Be curious. Ask the ex-evangelicals our stories. And, I mean, I think that's why I wrote the book, so that at least that there was something, and I know there's more emerging, but something in the academic literature, as well as that I hope it's accessible to those who are directly affected, lay readers, about, you know, this process of emerging. You know, for me, it feels like a kind of an ethical project for life, not so much to try and change the church, but to, because I'm not scared anymore, to have a voice for those who are coming behind, who are scared and fearful and distressed and depressed. I've come out, as it were.
You've come out. Well, and we were beholden.
Yeah, and I used my own name.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
Public on Twitter. I publicly speak. I've written it. So
I was
scared for a while. I really was scared.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know what happens in church communities to people who start speaking the way you and I do. But that's part of my ethical intention, that I'm not scared anymore. And so for those who are scared, you know, let others be a voice for you as you find your own way through this process.
We're no longer beholden to the system. And I think that was, I had the same type of experience. When I was a teacher at this Bible college over here in Britain, I would always challenge my students with the same kind of things that you were saying, and make them think and question things. But that all that did was get me in trouble. And so, as you say, I ended up losing my job, not necessarily because of that. The school was £400,000 in debt, but I'm pretty sure they were relieved to see me go. That was a convenient excuse for them to say, we can't afford to pay anybody anymore. So they let me go, and they've never contacted me again, surprisingly. No. But I don't want to be beholden to any system. I don't want to have to prop it up.
It's sad that they're not in touch with you and all of that, but not surprising as well.
No, it's not. But the fact is, and I've said this many times, the church needs to hear, like you said, the voices like ours. They need to hear what they're doing. But of course, if they weren't listening to us when we were in the system and then we tried from outside, why are they going to listen now? They're just going to double down. And these are the kind of trolls that I get on Twitter. And I'm sure you've had a few pieces of pushback here and there.
Oh, yes.
So that's what we're going to get.
I even get strange trolling if I speak in any challenging way against the evangelical church, strange triggering, saying that I'm kind of, all I am is a Muslim lover. I mean, that kind of strange trolling.
That doesn't even make
sense. I'm happy to be called a Muslim lover, quite frankly.
You're happy to call yourself. Yeah, it's just nuts. The pushback you get. I get people that quote Bible verses to me, and I think one lady posted up that I needed to download this app that has the teachings of Jesus that I get every day from the Gospels. And I'm what?
No,
you're not even listening.
I know. And look, sometimes I've had via direct messaging and whatever some quite respectful conversations with some Sydney evangelicals. I've been more public lately because I've been on news broadcasts or current affairs programs talking about this. That kind of can bring out some of the worst elements. Or again, which is kind of surprises me when it shouldn't surprise me, that even if I'm public, even if I'm appearing on the television, still some of those friends who had sworn to be friends for life, I never hear from them.
Not a word. Well, they're so threatened, though.
So they don't even say, I disagreed with you or anything. They ignore you.
Just nothing.
They ignore you.
They see you really as a threat, I think, and a traitor. Yep. You've not only turned your back on Christianity and God, you're actually now attacking the church, and therefore you are now our enemy. You're a traitor, especially since you and I were inside it.
Enough, I'm always very careful, and I hope I've been in this conversation, and I need to be, that I actually don't want to attack God.
Exactly.
I don't want to promote atheism. That's not at all where I'm coming from. I'm actually kind of anti-abuses of power more than anything else.
You've just discovered it in religion or in churches. Certainly the Abrahamic religions. Yeah, and what's wrong with talking about that? We need to get the stories out there. So I'm glad that you've written this book. So I'm definitely, it's on the list now. I need to read your book. This is another thing. How can people get a hold of you? What's the best way in terms of social media?
Well, the best way to get the book is from all the usual online sellers.
Yeah, you can do the Amazons and all that.
It's readily available. It's in paperback now, so it's not as expensive as it was as a hardback. It's in paperback, all people's usual online sellers. If they don't have an online seller, normally libraries will have it. If the library doesn't have it, normally a bookshop would get it in for you. It's published by Routledge, London, New York. It's a UK publishing house.
Yeah, so it's readily available.
And if they still don't know how to do it, I have a website, Josie McSkimming. I'm easy to find because my name's unusual. Very common in Scotland, but not common anywhere else.
Right, not in Australia.
And So I'm easy to find. People can contact me directly and ask how they can get hold of it. I don't mind.
Right. And then what's your Twitter handle? How can people follow you there?
Just Josie McSkimming.
Yeah, you're available.
They can find my website. They can email me. I'm actually very accessible because just Googling an unusual name means that you're found very readily.
You're going to find it,
I mean, I'm not kind of available to do a whole of unlimited counseling, I have to say that. I'm actually thinking of writing another book, but that's another story. So I'm trying to carve out a bit of time to think about another book.
Well, maybe,
and it's not about God this time.
It's not about God. I was going to say maybe we could have you back on the podcast to talk about your new book. But if it's not about God, I don't know what it's
about.
I love
it. But it might be years away.
Might be years away, but you never know. These conversations just kind of flow and they sort of go places. So you never know.
Sure.
But thank you so much for being on Mindshift Podcast. I've had a fantastic time getting to know you a little bit, as well as kind of sharing some of these stories. I'm glad you wrote your book. And when I read it, I'll have to get back in touch with you and we'll have another discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. And really, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. And I just hope it's been helpful to people. You just never know who listens. You know, I guess we're just hopefully speaking to those people who might not really have anybody else to talk to. And so just hearing our stories has been helpful.
Exactly. People need to know that they're not alone in this thing and they're not crazy. That's probably another big piece of it as well.
Well, and those who leave aren't crazy either, nor are we kind of so full of moral turpitude that you wouldn't want to know it.
Well, I sincerely hope that you are one of those people that Dr. Josie McSkimming was referring to, that by listening to her story and the story of people like myself, people like Cindy Wong Brandt, David Hayward, Chris Stroop, and so many other people that I've been talking to lately, that has helped you in your own journey of reconstructing after the deconstructing. Maybe you were one of those people too that earned a black belt in cognitive dissonance when you were part of a religious system, whether it be evangelical fundamentalist Christianity or some other controlling religion, where you had to live with that cognitive dissonance and suppress your doubts, suppress your concerns and your questions too. And of course, as we've talked about in this episode and as well last week, that if you suppress that cognitive dissonance, if you deny what is actually happening, what your experiences are, what's going to happen is those suppressed emotions and feelings and questions and doubts, they will absolutely manifest themselves in other ways in your life in terms of anxiety, depression, PTSD, and other symptoms that we hear about from therapists, from counselors, people like Dr. Josie who have to counsel people who are still in or maybe have just come out of fundamentalism or controlling religions and who are now trying to reconstruct a completely new identity. And this is something, of course, I keep going back to that I learned from David Hayward, the Naked Pastor. Because religion is so completely all-pervasive, it forms our very identities. It's very, very difficult to disentangle yourself from it. And a lot of things can trigger us even later, maybe years later. You'll hear a worship song or you'll see something on a flyer on TV or in a movie that, bam, triggers you and you're right back in it and you realize, man, I've got a lot of work to do. So hopefully this discussion with Dr. Josie has helped you to do a little bit of reconstruction along your journey. If it has helped you, I'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can also get a hold of Dr. Josie on Twitter as well. And I will put her links as well as my contact information, as always, in the show notes. Now, I'm going to say coming up next week, what's happening is I'm going to be bringing you my conversation that I had late this summer with my sister Valerie when she was visiting me here on The Rock. We did sort of a one-year update from our episode that we did last year when she was here before, where we talked about surviving a fundamentalist upbringing. So what has changed in the last year in both my life and in Valerie's life? It's a fascinating discussion. We've done a lot of reconstruction in the last year, and we kind of sat down and did a reflection piece. So I think that's going to be very helpful to hear those kind of stories and to kind of come along with us on our journey. So join me and my sister Valerie coming up next week when we bring you a one-year update to our podcast that we did. In fact, this gives you a chance, a good week or so, to go back into the archives. You can find it on Podbean as well as my own website, preachersforum.com. You can find that episode, and that'll give you a chance to kind of catch up and give yourself some context as to what we talked about last year in preparation for next week's episode coming out. So thanks for joining me and Dr. Josie McSkimming, as well as the other international guests that I've had recently, all the way from Canada, Taiwan, and Australia. We've kind of done a tour of the world. So thanks for coming along with me on this trip. And by no means is this journey over. I will see you next week along with my sister Valerie right here on Mindshift Podcast.